Well, thank you, Pastor Jen. It is now my honor after that to invite up Dr. Charles Amjad Ali. One of the reasons I'm excited to introduce him, a number of us here know him, and those who don't, I'll invite you to read a little bit about him. He's currently a professor of justice and Christian community at Luther Seminary. I've had a lot of professors. I've been at Luther now for a number of years in my education before them. What I really appreciate about Dr. Charles is he's interested in making disciples. And in a seminary context, it's sad to say, but it's hard to find. He has walked with me throughout the last few years, as he has others here. And he will often challenge those in his classroom with why it is that the American church is not suffering, when that seems to be an assumption that is present in the biblical text, that if we are going to follow Jesus, it means we are going to suffer, we are going to be persecuted, and that's a part of what it means just to take up our cross, which is there throughout, and to take seriously what it means to follow Jesus outside the gates. He himself has lived this, as Pastor Jen said. Even now, he continues to go back to contacts, back to Pakistan every other year. He'll be heading to South Africa, and I know his heart is to return to Africa or other parts of the world where he can continue the struggle, where it's heated, where it's alive, and where there is an energy and a real need. It's not that that's not present here in the U.S. It's needed here more than ever, and I know that's why he stayed here for so many years. He came here in 97 to teach at Luther Seminary, and he's still here. And he has influenced a number of students along the way. I really mean this. The only reason right now that I am at Luther and I've stayed at Luther is to study under him and to continue to learn from him, even as I've learned a number of good things from other professors. A couple of other points about him. He's done a lot. I mean, ask him to tell you a few stories. He worked in the early on with Benazir Bhutto. He was a dear friend of hers back in the day. He's a speechwriter for her. Many of you know the first woman leader of a Islamic State, and so he worked with her for some time. He's been involved in the apartheid struggle in South Africa. He has been in prison on a number of occasions in Pakistan and paid with his body. And still, he continues to come and to fight and to struggle and to put himself back into those contexts because that is what it means to be a Christian. The reason that we invited him here tonight, aside from this witness, and to pick up on a little bit of the spirit that he brings, which is a part of the reason we brought him here. The other thing is that if we're going to talk about these issues here in the church that Pastor Jen just laid out, we really need to be rooted in history. And we need a theological base for it. And so I've asked him to come here and to talk about the American church and empire, not just simply to critique empire, because that's one thing, but to take a hard look at the church and the church's relationship with it throughout so that we can understand ourselves now and the context that we are in now, and then to wrestle with what does it mean to be Christians in our time, in our place, and what is the good news? We really do want to focus here on the good news and offering something constructive and hopeful, but hope comes from entering into and following the cross. And so what does it mean for us to take up the cross here now, not just as individuals, as some sort of martyrdom or heroism, but as the collective body of Christ and as the church? And what does it mean for us to grapple with that together here as Christian brothers and sisters that represent a number of different traditions here, all in the Twin Cities context? So we'll talk about the church tomorrow, and I'm really looking forward to having Mark Van Steenwyck and Mark Jensen and Doran Schrantz and others sharing out of their context. But tonight we want to grapple with some hard issues of history, of context, of politics and theology. You know, religion and politics are always intertwined. We pretend that they're not, but they're always intertwined. And so how has that been the case here? And what sort of hope can we take from this now and new insights and new challenges to walk forward in our discipleship and following the cross? So with that, I invite Dr. Charles up to come and share with us. Yes, and you're welcome to share up there.
Being of Zacchaeus' height, I must stand up. So I thought I'll just come up and so you can see me better. It's actually wonderful being back here at All Nations. This has almost become a church away from church for me. I come here more regularly than I go to all the churches every Sunday. I'm on call at different places. This church, I come more regularly than I go to any other churches. So it's been actually been a wonderful experience. I teach at Luther Seminary. I come from a United Church. So you understand that that church is Lutheran, Calvinist, Anglican, and Methodist. You guys talk about ecumenism here, we achieve it. it's one of the earliest of the ecumenical churches. Some of you know me. I have a couple of students, a couple of PhD students who have gone through me over a long period of time, suffered with me, cried and laughed with me, and they're both now teaching and involved in it. And I'm hoping, thank you, my brother, hoping that John would be one of them soon, finishing his work. And all of you almost who are here in the church know me. So I'm glad to be here. And some of you, John, also here, who was one of the few Baptists I knew in the days when we were really struggling in the heyday of the time when the September 11th happened. John was there with us, and we did a series of conversation about the war going to happen in Iraq. And I was so wrong. I said it'll last only 6 months and not 2 months, as George Bush said, if you remember that conversation. Some of you know me, but others do not. Pastor Jin has introduced the issue very well. John has introduced me, and you have seen my... I basically want to say two things. One, that I'm a Christian out of conviction. I'm not defending a DNA. I'm not defending a heritage of my parents or a denominationalism that I have to protect because of my ethnicities. None of those loyalties work for me. I hope you know. So when I talk about my loyalty, there is a loyalty which comes out of a very different source. I hope you understand when I say that I'm not using the word evangelical for myself because of where the direction has gone with it. I remain an evangelical Christian, but I don't like where some of the direction has gone. I hope you understand this, okay? Because it has claimed a solidarity with the gospel and has not followed through on it. So that's one of the things I have said. So I remain highly committed Christian, willing to not only talk about it at seminaries, but live it out. As John mentioned, I go to Pakistan, and those of you who know that if you are a convert from Islam, your life is not really worth much at the end of the day. So it's not an easy statement for me to be a Christian. But why I say that is, what is wrong with the Western church that it doesn't face the same Democles of faith? Christ never said you should drive a Cadillac and, you know, follow me. You know, when that happens, then we'll start changing the Bible. It says, take up your cross and follow me. If you deny me, I will deny you also. So the Lutheran justification by itself does not stand on the biblical text. So let me push those issues out. I hope my evangelical brothers and sisters do not get offended with what I'm going to say, though. Because I'm going to talk about the claim to biblical solidarity is not always followed in a claim to Christian discipleship. And that's the question I'm going to raise. Okay. In this presentation, I will lay out some critical aspects of the American empire, the history of its socio-political and economic power, and the kind of knowledge that this power generates. Remember, there's no knowledge without an exercise of power. Remember, please, those of you who know your Greek, know that the question was, is knowledge virtue or is knowledge power? That's there already in Plato and Aristotle, if you want to meet it through. Is knowledge episteme, the three words, episteme, epistemology, gnosis, Gnosticism, all that knowledge leads you either to power or it leads to a virtuous life. Either leads to a good citizenship or it leads you to power. That's the debate. And right now, what education has become is not only technological power, but job-getting power. It's not knowledge for the sake of having knowledge and good citizenship. It's knowledge for the sake of getting job. It is pragmatic, flat Machiavellian read. Okay, that's the debate. We are having this debate at Luther Seminary right now. What are we producing? I will also focus on the unique aspects of the theology behind this contemporary American imperialism, and how it has evolved in this context and provides fundamental moral underpinning for this empire, justifying its contemporary and manifold manifestations. We constantly justify everything that America does in religious categories. Even when we've taken God out of it, there are still religious values. You get it? I mean, in the secularization of the debate, God has been removed out, but they come out of a foundational Christian value. So they are far less controlled by a responsibility to God, but by a responsibility to power. So that's just to lay this out as a point of introduction. I think this is most fully expressed in the various strands of contemporary conservative Christian theology, which I argue apparently paradoxically, is both a rebellion against enlightenment, epistemology, scientific rationality, but also is its most significant offspring. Notice what I just said. It is its most significant offspring of enlightenment and scientific rationality on the one hand, while it is claiming a critique of it as a central position. The individuality that is required by this theology is a product of enlightenment. Never before has that individuality been expressed the way it is. It's an isolated, vying individuality. It's not only that I am isolated from everybody else, but I am in a vying, competitive existence with the others. This is Hobbes. This is liberalism, by the way. I keep telling my Republican brothers, you are the most liberals of all the people I know. So don't tell me about liberal and conservative. You're not conservative. Conservative would put you in a community. So you are the most liberal people I know. Reagan, when I was still teaching at Princeton, I used to say Reagan was the most Republican at that time, was the most liberal president we ever had. Because there was no community of identity making. It was I, myself, for myself. Individual, completely, without even recognizing that we are today scientifically knowledgeable that I'm a product of a community. I have a DNA in me. You know why I have black hair, why I have brown eyes, all a product of community. There is no isolated individuality, neither biologically possible nor philosophically applicable. And yet we live with that myth. And the evangelical Christianity has become part of that myth by arguing for an individual conversion as a requirement for faith rather than living in and out of a community for a community. So it's a voluntary associational model rather than organic model based on the cross. So we all get together because we like each other. So the church grows. My brothers, Galen Mathiesen, who's a great missiologist with me who studied, knows the whole argument of the church growth movement was homogeneous principle. That if you are all like me, we will all be happy with each other. But the problem I have is I have this Korean man sitting next to me. How do I deal with him? I'm talking with my friend here, so I can talk, otherwise I wouldn't be able to talk. You know, you get it? So all of a sudden, the diversity causes a problem of comfort, which causes a problem of the church growth. So we don't know how to deal with classes difference. We don't know how to deal with racial differences. We don't know how to deal with sexual differences. We don't know how to deal with all the differences which every community has. And we want to grow in a voluntary associational homogeneous principle. And that great makes the church grow. That's the problem with that ideology. It's very much a part of the Enlightenment heritage at this point. And Enlightenment did this as a critique of the Reformation. My brother was hinting at it. It's exactly what happened after the Reformation. We all love Reformation. I teach at a Lutheran seminary. You know, we talk about Reformation more often than we talk about Jesus Christ. Is that right, Gail? There are 4 or 5 of you, right? We talk about that. But here is the problem, that immediately following the Reformation, 10 or 7.5 million, depending on who's counting, people were killed for that denominational generation. It was called the Bloody 30-Year War. People forget this little history, right? That the Calvinists were killing the Lutherans were killing the Calvinists, everybody was killing the Catholics were killing everybody else. And of course, the Anabaptists were free targets. You didn't have to worry because nobody's going to attack you from their side, right? Those guys did not have war. They were pacifists. So you can kill them with impunity. They had no princes protecting them. They had no rights, right? So you could just kill them. So the creation of the imperial model that happens in Constantine is now brought here into a statecraft, as you were rightly pointing it out. It is a reduction of the power, not change of method. So we had a Holy Roman Emperor, and we had a Holy Roman Pope. We now had bishops, and we had princes. Treaty of Westphalia, written in 1648, which begins the formation of modern nation-state system. All of you who have done political science, political theory, anything know that treaty. The Treaty of Westphalia, written by a Calvinist lawyer, theologian, by the name of Hugo Grotius. He writes this because we are incapable of maintaining peace and order. And that's why the individual and not a collective identity comes out. It comes out of the crisis of Christian faith. Liberalism did not go against Christianity. It was produced by Christianity as its heir because it had failed. So it's a bastard child. Please understand that nobody wants to claim paternity to it. Only Kant. Right? And those of you who know, and René Descartes. Those are the two people who want to claim that the isolated individual is what the thing is all about. Whether it is cogito ergo sum or it's ding and sich traditions. I think, therefore, I am. I don't need God. I don't need you. You exist because I can think about you. You don't exist in yourself. Till I could see you, Pastor Jin, you existed, but that doesn't matter to me. You only matter when I can think about you. So notice what it does. It reduces you to my mind. You don't have a being of your own. A collective identity. All that is gone. So these traditions that came about, and we followed that in the Christian heritage. Those of you who have studied at Princeton all know that we were all Barthian, one form or the other, Kantians. Oh, neo-Kantianism ruled supreme. Is that true? He's the latest of the Princeton product, so I can talk to him. I was there when they were setting up this Princeton model of thought. Right? We were all doing down this. All we were reading was Kant. We had forgotten everybody else. What Descartes says about cogito ergo sum, evangelical Christians said, credo ergo sum. I believe, therefore I am. Nobody said Christus ergo sum, because Christ is I am. It was a displacement of Christ, and my acceptance of Christ made the sacrifice applicable. Aspirin is not an aspirin in itself till I eat it. Otherwise, aspirin has no value. The question that came out of that kind of liberal political theory now goes to theology. I'm going to rush through this so that I take the preface out. The contemporary Euro-American history, an imperial model does not start of now. We keep talking about it now. It's now an acceptable word. But remember, the imperial model begins first with Christopher Columbus, who is considered to be our founder. Right? I hope you understand this. The model begins in 1492. In 1492, Christopher Columbus, what sailed the ocean blue, right? All those things you know, right? Pincas, Nincas, and Anna Marie. With a Franciscan monks in each of the boats. I hope you know that this time the church is divided between the nominalists and the Dominicans. The nominalists are Franciscans and the Dominicans are setting up the scholastic orders. So the mission, what was Christopher Columbus going to trade with India? I ask you, any one of you, all of you have done this history at various points. What did he have to trade? What did Spain have to trade with India? Remember, he thought he had come to India. That's why the people are called Indian. I hope you know that he thought he had landed up in India. Till 1517, he thought he was in India. His son kept telling him, no, this is not India. No, it is India. You know, this is how people think. You can always create a world for yourself out of a Cartesian modeling. Not only I think about it and I become, but what I think about you is also true, right? I think, sorry, I'm looking at you. You know, all Princeton people are Bharatiyas, because I know that. Right? I'm looking at people I can talk about, right? This is where the problem was. 1492, 800 years, 781 years of Muslim rule in Spain. How many of you know that? 781 years of Muslim rule in the heartland of then Europe. Remember, Europe is on the west coast and the Mediterranean. The rest are all barbarians, all of you who are coming from Scandinavian country. Remember that. You are Vandals, you are Goths, you are Visigoths. You are these are all barbarians vis-a-vis Mediterranean. Exactly. Thank you. Exactly. You came with your horn. You didn't even know how to put on proper metal plates on your head. I hope you know this. This is not me making it up. The Greek and the Romans called them Barbaros. The Mediterranean was the oikomene, the household of civilized people. That's why I don't like the word oikomene. That boat was for the civilized people. The Mediterranean was the center of the earth, Medi-Tierra. Right? I hope you understand. The territory, the word comes from the Tierra. And Medi-Tierra was not the land, but the sea between the lands. Only German language actually names it Mittelmeer. Everybody else calls it Mediterranean in different forms. It's very interesting to know the language roots. And what surrounded it? Was southern Spain, France, Albania, Italy, down North Africa and Syria. Therefore, all the anti-Nicene fathers, those of you who know your church history, are North Africans. Not one of them is a European. How are we going to deal with that? The gospel and the location of the early church, Middle East. All the anti-Nicene father, location, Africa. What has European contributed to this theology? I'm sorry, I just want to ask a question. I asked this question to my Lutheran brothers who are teaching with me. You've got a problem, right? So you have to then take it over as an imperial power. You then locate yourself with Rome and continuity with Greece and continuity with Constantinople. Where is Constantinople located? Those of you who know your geography. Asia Minor. Asia Minor, even by the Roman standards. Remember this. It is located where now is Istanbul. From 314 or 15 or 20, depending on the dates, all the way up to 1453, this is the center of the Roman Empire. We, because we didn't like that, made Roman Empire divided into two. All of us learned this. Eastern and Western Roman Empire. Where was this Western Roman Empire? Who was the emperor in the West? Till the coming of Charlemagne as a Carolingian fighter. Please look at your own history. I'm not telling you anything from the Muslims always called Rome, Istanbul. I hope you know this. They never thought of Rome as what we call Italian Rome. So when you have Maulana Rumi, those of you who know anything about mystical Islam, this great mystical saint, he is from Istanbul. So just to give you this, so how do we deal with 1492 on the one side, and that lasted up to 1588 when the English defeated the Spanish Armada by this criminal, Sir Walter Raleigh, right? I hope you know he was working with the pirates at that time, right? He was taking away tobacco from here, robbing things from here and taking it out. This is the beginning of this history, right? This is happening here in Virginia's. This is Virginia. This is the beginning of the first English colony. It's not Jamestown, it's Roanoke. The Puritans who were running away from England came and settled here. And they died. That died. Completely, that died a complete death till they come to Portsmouth in Mayflower. Now, I lived on the East Coast for about 15 years. Everybody has some connection with Mayflower, you know that. If you want to be establishing yourself as a Brahmin, you have to have a connection with Mayflower. If you don't have a connection with Mayflower, oh, you must have come from the poor background of, not for religious persecution you ran away, but you ran away for economic reasons, and you couldn't say that you ran away from Europe for economic reasons. So all of them came because of religious persecution. I hope you understand that. That's the great myth of the new empire. Right? So Puritans are the only ones who came. No. The Quakers were this much larger group of people. Those of you who have any connection with Pennsylvania know William Penn was the great man of contemporary political development. And he came to Pennsylvania because of William Penn. But we all like Puritan background to this empire. We don't like the Quaker background to this empire. You know that 102 people landed from Mayflower here. I hope you know all that history, right? The first winter, they had never seen winter like that. You think Europe is cold. Yet, until you come here, you don't know how warm Europe is, you know. I lived in Europe for a long time, so coming here was an experience of coldness. I thought East Coast was cold. And I came here 15 years ago. I am still living in penance. No, God has given me a punishment to go to this land called Minnesota, and I live here. But that's the beginning of our empire. The other side of the beginning of the empire, and that is a side that we don't like to talk about, by the 1890s, America was an imperial power. I hope you know this, right? By 1895, we had taken over Philippines. People don't want to remember that part, right? So we were always liberators for Philippines, never a colonial empire for Philippines. All you want to read, there's a very interesting, all of you probably know this, called The White Man's Burden. Do you know? Rudyard Kipling, the great colonial poet who wrote all his poetry in India. I hope you know that. That's the connection between the American connection. You know, he was actually a poet living in India, wrote Kim there, those of you who know his books. He wrote a book called The White Man's Burden, and it's actually white man. The whole title of the thing is, he wrote this actually, the United States and the Philippine Islands. It's called the full title, White Man's Burden, the United States and the Philippine Islands, written in 1899. And I'm going to read you, all of you know the line of the White Man's Burden, but people don't know the first verse. There's seven verses in that poem. The first verse reads like this. Take up white man's burden. Send forth the best ye breed. This is the missionary also argument. The best ye breed. Go bind your sons to exile, to serve your captives' need. They're not your people, they are your captives. This is how he saw the act of colonialism. And then he says, to wait in heavy harness on fluttered folks and wild, your new caught sullen people, new caught sullen people, it's like the Africans who were brought here, your new caught sullen people, half devil and half child. Please, this is written in 1899, too long ago. Just 100-year-old poetry. And this is written after the Civil War here. Get the context here. This is written after 1865. And these languages were still prevalently approaching language. Because of the power that the West has exercised globally over the last 500 years, there have been other colonial experiences. The minute you mention the word empire, they said, well, you know, the Arabs had their empire. Everybody immediately expand the concept of empire. But in 500 years, nobody else has had empires of the nature. Japan tried it in Korea, you know, in China, and failed. Every time they turned around, there was not settled empire. The largest empire was set up by the Muslims. They never made anybody speak their language. Even today, nobody speaks Turkish. Not even the Albanians. Not even the Serbians. I was colonized, I'm speaking English. He was colonized, he speaks English. Sorry. I was only colonized for 90 years, and I speak English, right? Because that's the language of the colonial power. The Turks colonized, they neither forced Arabic to speak Turks. Now that the Persians. This is very interesting how the empire models have to be looked at in different forms, right? In different expressions. So, because of the power of the West, has exercised globally over the last 500 years, they have generated and manufactured mythical historical structures and said this is the truth, right? Remember, I was not trying to be funny when I said Christianity did not come to Western Europe till 1000 AD in some of the parts of the country, in Scandinavia. Remember, and it was brought in by the Catholics. There was no Protestants around. I mean, I hope you understand this thing, right? And it is the monks coming from Ireland who bring Christianity, the Columba tradition. That's why, if those of you who have Scottish, you are talking about John Knox, that whole Iberian and connection that is there with these things, right? That's why there are all these redhead and blondes and all that, because Scandinavian were coming and taking over those areas and doing things, you know, as only empires do, right? Producing children which were not needed or required. And we did not have, even though they were raped, they could not have abortions. And they could not produce, unlike Mr. Aiken's comment about, you know, they produce children. That's why we have all these blondes and blue-eyed and red-haired people in the northern part of England. Any challenge to the veracity of this myth, if I challenge it, I'm immediately condemned as symptomatic of all that is wrong with victims because they're ontologically incapable of objectivity, whereas when we claim a European history, it's objective. Remember, we, in the North Atlantic context, I live here. This is why I'm calling myself a we here. I don't call myself an outsider. If I'm benefiting from it, this is a place I must own both its guilt and both its gladness. Right? We fought two wars, between 1918 and 1945. 11 and a half years of two wars, the most rational societies, the most enlightened society, the most scientifically advanced societies fought those two wars. Religion is still condemned for being the cause of war. Nobody condemns enlightenment as the cause of the war. Very interesting, isn't that? The only wars which are called world wars were fought by these enlightened societies. 3,000 people died. We call it religious war very quickly. Just Germany alone killed 6 million Jews. We didn't see this enlightenment center where Kant and Hegel and Marx and Husserl and all these people had been there, produced those wars and produced the level of killing that never had been experienced by efficient killing, because we had the mechanical means and know how to do it. We could guess that. Killing takes a lot of effort. This required less effort. You could burn them. Right? Scientific rationality. The two centers of what was called enlightenment was Germany and England. I hope you know that, right? One was the beginning of the law of motions, and that enlightenment that was produced mechanics and industrial revolution and produced capitalism. And this society produced all the enlightenment philosophy and produced great music. Those of you who do music, you have Bach and Beethoven and, you know, Brecht's poetries and Heinrich's poetries. All these things are coming from these two centers and not coming from other countries. And they are the two centers of the war. And we call them rational wars, are we? So should we blame Europe for starting wars? But the history is the world fought these wars. These are true tribal wars. How many of you know Archduke Ferdinand? Who the hell was he? Yes. He shoots somebody and we start a war, a tribal war. Every other war is called tribal, but the Europeans, when they fight with each other, it's called world wars, right? I hope you know this. So this is where the problem comes in. Who defines and how the mythology gets developed? This is the imperial modeling of things. It does not accept contribution of anything. Those of you who have just drunk coffee have just drank the most Muslim drink that you can possibly get. You have all become Muslim, according to the church. I hope you know this. There were fatwas passed by cardinals and by Vatican, that if you drink coffee, you will become a Muslim. Did you know this? You know what the best bean is called? It's called Arabica. Not by any accident. It's an Arab drink. In the second attack at Gate of Vienna, the Turks left coffee. Nobody knew what the hell this was. And they said, why did the Turks leave? I hope you know this, right? Why did the Turks leave? They were winning the war. They had laid a siege. They would have won the war and they left. And all they left behind is coffee. Don't drink this coffee. That is their conspiracy against the Christians. And they passed 36 fatwas I have collected so far. I write on material history. I don't write on war heroes. I write on matter. You know, what is salt? What is coffee? What is spices? How they move? How they interact? Today we have Coca-Cola, right? We count Coca-Cola as an imperial thing. We don't count coffee as an imperial drink because it's our drink. Europe does not produce the basic drinks it drinks, coffee or tea. They're not produced anywhere in Europe. Think of it for a moment. And yet it is our drink. So when I came here, everybody said, oh, Charles, did you learn to drink coffee while you've been here? I said, where the hell did you get it from? And I went here and I drank tea. And they would say, where did you learn how to drink tea? I said, where did you learn? Oh, did you learn it while you were at Oxford? I said, no, they learned it from us. You see, this is the imperial history. The mythologies of imperial history is claiming direct ownership of things which are not their own. It's like Christianity becomes a Western religion. Where? You get it? That's the question. So here we are, sola scriptura, and we make it a Western religion. If you're going to go sola scriptura, you've got to go to the Middle East. Folks, I'm sorry. You can't deal with it as a European text. It is not a European text. It is written by, for, within, inside Middle Eastern context. It's as Middle Eastern as the Quran is. How are we going to deal with that? That's the problem with this imperial modeling. That imperial modeling takes away, and now we have made it into Enlightenment text. I was trained in the beginning of the historical critical method. You know, we did all the JP and D. You guys had gone beyond it at the time. But I was a product of that. Galen, you were partly part of that, at least part of the period. Right? All of a sudden, this text was a purely European product. It was a debate whether this was going to be appropriate in the Geistliche Frage of a German text. You know, it's a spiritual question. They were not dealing with that question. I hope you know this. Till up to the point of 1948, almost all the Holy Land, almost every place that is mentioned in the Bible, whether it's Old Testament or New Testament, was in the hand of the Muslims. How the hell are we going to deal with this? Please understand what I just said. Till the creation of the state of Israel, all those pieces belonged to the Muslims. And we did not know how to deal with, never dealt with Islam. We don't even now know, after 11 years of struggling with the Islamic world, we don't know. That's what the imperial history does to us. We don't deal with the people who are, because they don't matter. And the problem is, Islam is not going away. Remember that 1,400 years of Christianity and 1,400 years of Islam, if you take them and put them together, we think we are the biggest religion. We are not. If you take the right proportions of period. If you take 1,400 years of church history, and take 1,400 years of Islamic history and put them in parallel, look at the outreach and the globe outreach that Islam has. We were nowhere near that. When did the Jesuits become Jesuits? 1540. The first missionary order, right? Set up in the order. Not the Dominicans, they were predicatum, but not missionary. Society of Jesus is the first real missionary order. And those of us who are Protestant doing mission, follow the Jesuit order. I hope you know this, right? So Galen is sitting down there. He did this really magnificent dissertation for me on the dealing of the issue in Northeast Asia. Everyone was a Jesuit. Ricci. all of these guys, right? So one of the problems that you get is whose epistemology controls. The problem that we have is with Jesus. You know, you take Jesus out, we can be an imperial power. No problem. He's been killed by the empire. Whose side are we on? Are we on the side of Pontius Pilate, Caesar, or on the side of the crucified? And the day we make that decision, the decision is then very clear. Where does a Christian faith stand vis-a-vis the empire? There is just no location unless you give up on Christ. You give up on Christ. I can side up with Caesar. But if I give up on Christ, I could, why the hell do I need to have a Roman Empire? I'll go back to Islam. Islam is far more successful than Roman Empire was. Right? I hope you know that. There's not a single empire as successful as Islam. If success is the criteria, why should I be a Christian? It is precisely the disaster of Christ that I'm a Christian for. We are all Abrahamic Christian when we look for that imperial power that you're talking about. This power of wealth. Oh, if you are Christian, you'll get wealth, you'll get power, you'll get all the things. Please show me, how do you justify this theologically at any point? If Christ had been successful, this is Abrahamic Christianity, I call it, right? It's got nothing to do with Christian Christianity. Longevity, land, progeny. Right? As far as your eyes are cast, that will be your land. You will have children that cannot be counted like the sand as the hair on your head. And you will die a ripe old age. Here's a 30 to a 33-year-old unmarried guy who dies. What success is in there? Please, I mean, let's talk about materiality. If we are not going to talk about Christology, let's talk about materiality and tell me, where do you fit Christ into it? So here's a 33-year-old guy who dies, unmarried. Foxes have holes, birds have nests, son of man, not even a stone to lay his head on. This is my Messiah, not Caesar. The problem is that we have chosen Caesar in place of Jesus. We have chosen Abraham in place of Caesar, of Jesus. The minute we do that, then we look for wealth. We look for success. We look for the criteria of blessings coming to us. Where is the blessing to this man? None of his disciples lived long enough to find any of that blessing. How come we are getting the blessing and they didn't, who were closest to Christ? This is this quid pro quo investment theology of Wall Street. What has that got to do with the cross of Christ? That's what this is. This is, if I put $1 of good work, I should get $10 returned back to me. This is Romney doing Bain economics. Sorry for those of you who are Republic. This has got nothing to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Nothing. It is anti-Christ, as you say. Now, you can capitalize it if you want, or you can leave it small if you want. But it is anti-Christ. Because it's saying that Jesus must have been a sinner, therefore he got no age, no children, Dan Brown books notwithstanding. Right? No children, no land. He was even a disastrous teacher. For 3.5 years, he has disciples. One of them betrays him, and betrays him with a kiss. Right? You do this as an intimate sign. Right? If you're in the Middle East, you know, you kiss people. Here, you can't do that. Because if you do that, you are a gay man, obviously. Right? So they actually kiss each other. The guy comes and kisses him. And that's the indication to the hegemon. Remember this text. Please understand the word. Hegemon is the governor who is a Roman Empire. And I'm giving up my lord, my teacher, to an imperial power. That's what's happening here. We don't like this. And the zealot in Peter takes out his sword and he says, hell, I'm not letting this guy, Jewish boy, being taken away by this Roman Empire. He's not talking about his lord. He's talking about his colleague who's a Jew. And he cuts his ear off. Remember that story? I mean, all of us know this story. Jesus did not say, don't carry sword. He just said, put it in the scabbard. I mean, those of you who are Mennonite. You know that he allowed them to carry a sword in the first place. You know, at least I was talking to one couple there at the back. So I know there's at least one couple who's a Mennonite. Are you a Mennonite? Okay. I've lived with the Mennonites longer than I have lived with the Lutherans, so I can deal with the Anabaptist question better. You know? But take these things seriously. This is about the Lord who dies on the cross. This is about our claim as Christian, is God who died on the cross. Is a crucified God, to quote Moltmann. This is the one who dies for you rather than create an empire. And what are we doing in his name? We're justifying an empire, doing unjust things around the world. And we give it theological justification. And that's where the problem is. I don't care what the empire must do their empire work. But my problem is with the church selling out its message, its gospel, its teaching, its central core of faith. It is selling out its God to the hegemon. Remember, this is the passage. Those of you who remember Luke 20, 20 to 26, this is the context of that passage of two kingdoms, which the Lutherans use for quietism. Well, anyway, how many of you are Lutheran here? But, you know, I mean, I teach with them. So they said, because of the two kingdoms, you cannot get involved in the kingdom of man on the right hand, the left hand of God, right? You and I were struggling with that in 2001. Remember, October, before I almost died at that period, because just before we met, then I was in hospital, if you remember, for 8 weeks. People thought I had pancreatic cancer. But we were talking about it there already, that we have to do something about it. And the people said, no, but that's getting too much involved in the right hand and the left hand kingdom. Getting them that same, there may be two hands, but that is the same God. I keep telling them, yes, they're not two gods. Yet, I'm a left-handed person. I'll have a serious problem with the left-hand kingdom because I can't keep quiet with my left hand. I am a left-handed person. So the right hand is my quiet hand. They say the right hand is of God. So let me do with my left hand what I do with my left hand, which is always to be actively involved in the world that God loves. And loves for the wretched and the poor. I'm not talking about liberation theology. You show me one place where wealth is dignified in the mouth of Jesus. And the only passage you will quote me is, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and we all sing this with great glory, and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. If you seek the kingdom of God, you're not going to look for Mercedes Benz. The first thing you will give up is that Mercedes Benz quest, if you seek the kingdom of God. It is because you do not seek the kingdom of God, you look for Mercedes Benz as justifying your existence. Right? If you seek the kingdom of God, that's not what you look for. That's not the quest of a Christian. The question is, kingdom of God is the righteousness. And I use the word kingdom. You know, it's a problematic concept, I hope you know. And this is not mine. The Puritans, whom you like, gave up on the word kingdom. I hope you know that. You know why? Because Charles I was beheaded by Cromwell. Charles II retrieves the monarchy. As he retrieves the monarchy, the Puritans get punished. That's why they run away here to come to Portsmouth. So monarchy for them is a bad notion. And those of you who are Calvinists must take great comfort. That's the part of Calvin that you should remember. Right at the end of the Institute in Book 4, right at the end, is a section which says, if the king does not fulfill the covenant of justice, the king must go. Romans 13, for the first time interpreted with a radical commitment. No father of the church had interpreted Romans the way Calvin did. So he said, lesser magistrate should get rid of the king. And Cromwell saw himself as a lesser magistrate, so he gets Charles I's head chopped off. I hope you know that history. Our democracy is not Greek democracy. It's a democracy that is produced out of this Calvinist heritage. I hope you understand that, all of us who are Catholics or anything else, or Methodist or Lutheran. I'm an Anglican, right? I hope you know this. So I know this bloody history. And I use the word bloody consciously. It's a crazy guy who wants to get married. He screws up the church. Right? You know, it's a libido taking over rather than the kingdom. You know, he's trying to get, he destroys all the abbeys in England. I hope you know how empires work, right? They work insidiously taking and sucking your soul. They don't work on just hurting your body. I hope you understand that. The first thing they take is your soul, because they know if they've got your soul, the body does not really matter. I've got, did you tell me 5 more minutes? Yeah. Oh, okay, good. So that's the second point. I just wanted to bring this into you, that understand that the Christian commitment is radically against an imperial modeling, because imperial modeling demands a loyalty which a Christian cannot afford. Of all the people, Paul Tillich, I'm teaching right now, and John is sitting in the doctoral seminar. Paul Tillich says that any time a penultimate reality begins to act like an ultimate reality, you are in an idolatrous relationship. And if you're in an idolatry relationship, even with nationalism. I mean, I remember in September 11th, look at me, I mean, I've got a beard, my name is Amjad Ali, you know. I mean, my skin is brown, and I was traveling in and out. Every time I traveled, there was a random check. I was a random who was always checked, right? I hope you know. And they probed me, and they touched me in places. If I was a gay man, I would love what they did to me, but... I hope you know. They touch you at places, you know, where, you know, you get very embarrassed if anybody from outside, even, you know. So, I had people come to my house. Gillen and I have a very dear friend. Alan came in a colonel's uniform. He was a chaplain in the military reserve. He was my PhD student. Had just finished PhD on Moltmann. And he came with his military van and came in front of my house. And all my neighbors said, oh, they've got Charles. Now here is a terrorist. They finally got him, right? So I'm standing. I come out because I see a military truck. I don't see Alan coming out, right? And I say, oops. My reaction exactly. And Alan comes out and he says, Charles, I just came to check with you about a paper I'm writing. So we sat in the house, and then we walked out, and he gave me this big hug. And then the army truck went. We didn't even realize. Then people came to, oh, is he a friend of yours? I said, yeah, he's a student of mine. He's a colonel in the army. I said, yes, he's a colonel in the army. And he didn't do anything to you. I said, no, he just came to see me about a paper he's working on. That's when I got accepted. You got to understand this. He didn't do this consciously. It would have been contrived and done well, but it was not. I was a victim, right? I could have almost always had somebody break my windows or do something to me. Because I'm living in all this very white area, right? It's even though it's 5 minutes from downtown St. Paul, but the area is old Polish worker area. This is working class, you know. So I'm just telling you that the empire actually dislocates you. I would say I'm a Christian. You say, how come you're a Christian? I would put a card out that I'm teaching at Luther Seminary. So they thought I was putting it on. If I wore a collar, which I do on Sunday, now and then, then they would check on me much more than if I was not wearing a collar because they saw that as a camouflage. You get it? I was wearing a dog collar to hide and pretend I was a Christian and I was not. Empire lives in fear of the people it victimizes. It doesn't live with the joy of a missiological Christianity, which lives by going outdoor. Fortresses are a wonderful thing to protect you from enemies from outside, but they also cannot allow you to go out. The church, which is the church of Jesus Christ, must be a missiological church. And if it is not, it has lost the very raison d'etre for its existence. Because the church is always in the service of the world, not for its own preservation. When I teach my class in ethics, I say, this pulpit, this church, this worship service is the rehearsal for the life in the world. This is not where you worship God. You only rehearse what it means to worship God in the world. Because it's the serving of the world that Jesus died. Jesus did not die for the church. I hope you understand this. He died for the world. Even at the narrowest point of St. John's gospel, God so loved the world, not the church. Right? At the narrowest point. That's the problem with the empire. It has to love itself. It cannot love the world. It sees the world as an enemy. It lives out of fear. The American embassies around the world and the Israeli embassies are the most defended embassies I have been around the world, all over. And those of you who have traveled know, you go to South Africa. Look at the South African consulate in Cape Town. The most defended places are embassies of Israel because they are dislocated places. Last point I want to make is that we have seen this as an exceptional nation, right? I hope you know one of the problems that Obama had was that he would not always do a chorus work on the with that America being an exceptional nation, right? Even though he's been saying more often than I would like him to say, but that be the case. But then I am very different. I mean, to me, Obama is the choice. I say that not because I'm trying to make you anyone, but he's not my, what you call, ontological conscious choice. Do you see the difference I'm trying to make here? He's my choice because all other alternatives are so poor. He's not my, and I'm not going to vote. But because as those of you who are Calvinists will know, you must participate. Because if you don't, if the lesser magistrate don't do it, you must take the responsibility of changing the order of power. This is Calvin, the last section of it. And he says, God be with you in the end. Right, the last word, right? That's the last section, pushes that responsibility of statecraft. Calvin pushes us into politics, which had been taken away from us after Rome. The problem that you have is that Islam, and I bring Islam in not because I come out of Islam, because Islam is going to be right there with us. If you're going to talk about tares and wheat, that's where the reality really sits with. It's not something we are going to keep out. We are spending, we are all talking about money right now. Is it 5 trillion, 7 trillion? I mean, they throw these numbers out, you know. I don't even know how many zeros are there in trillion. I mean, once I figure that out, then I'll know what the economy is going to do or not do, right? But I don't know. We are living in all these things. All this money has been spent on war. Right? They're estimating right now between $7 and $13 trillion. We are fighting officially two wars, right? But we're actually fighting three wars with the potential of two wars looming around the corner, right? We have Iraq. I'm sorry, it is not resolved as yet. Everybody wants to claim it is resolved. Therefore, we have so much peace going on. Just yesterday, this morning, they blew up a whole thing. And I don't know if you've been following the news. We're fighting a war in Afghanistan. The third war, which is an over-architectonic war, is a war against terrorism, in which there is no enemy to be defined. Right? We throw the word Al-Qaeda at random. Libya never had Al-Qaeda. Gaddafi never allowed Al-Qaeda to come in. You know, as a matter of fact, they came in when we allowed Gaddafi to go. I hope you know this, the Middle East politics. If you understand the Middle East politics, these are not people who are going to do our bidding just because they're struggling for democracy. Because they're going to go democratic, that doesn't mean they're going to follow America. As a matter of fact, if they go democratic, they're least likely to go American, pro-America. Armies go pro-American, not democracies. Please understand this. The Somosas go, not the Sandinistas. Right? The Rios Mott goes, not the elected governments in Guatemala. It's not going to be democratic governments which are going to follow America. It's going to be the military dictatorship who are dependent upon our patronage to keep them alive. We were giving the largest aid to three countries, all run more or less by armies. The state of Israel was number one, Egypt was number two under Mubarak, and Pakistan was number three under Zia-ul-Haq, under military dictatorship. I was jailed by him, so I know. I'm not talking about how democratic this guy was. I can tell you. Benazir Bhutto, a woman, never done in Pakistan, was in jail with us. We were fighting for human rights. We were fighting for rights of women. We were fighting for the rights of labor. We were doing. I had gone back from here teaching at Columbia to Pakistan. And we were in and out of jail. To me, that was the Christian mission. The witness of what makes me tick is that everybody's right is preserved. Empires hate anybody's right but their own. Therefore, a Christ must be crucified because his right must be taken away. Otherwise, this bloody rabble will claim to be the king of the Jews. Remember, he's not killed as a religious leader. People want to make him religious. He's killed as a political person. Even the stigma on the cross is Jesus of Nazareth, the king of the Jews. How can you have a king not appointed by the empire? If you have, that king has to go. That's what we do in foreign policy right now. I mean, if we don't like a person, and then we have a problem. We got rid of Egyptian monarchy, politics. We did not like when the monarchies were destroyed and we fought monarchy. I hope you know Egyptian politics that is coming up to our neck now. Farouk was taken out by Gamal Abdel Nasser, but he was a socialist, so we didn't like them. So we read all the fundamentalists come up. We raised all these fundamentalist boys and girls that are killing us. Every one of them are illegitimate children of our intelligence or lack thereof. Taliban, Al-Qaeda, all these are product of our imperial policy. The Christian gospel, if it is not inclusive, can never be a gospel. Bringing you to the point of the issue, the two issues that are facing us in this election are both about excluding people. It's not about election of representative. That, do what you like. But when it becomes an exclusivizing principle, then a Christian must stand up and be counted with those whom I may not like. But he cannot be excluded. Because the gospel does not allow me to exclude. That exclusion is at the cost of the gospel, and I can't. I may not agree with a person. I may not agree with their ideology. I may not agree with things. But that's an irrelevant question to the witness that I have to hear. If I only love the people I like, then even hypocrites do it, according to the Bible. You know, it is the one we don't know. And remember the biblical text, and I'm going to finish this, which is the greatest of the commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your might, with all your intelligence, right? Mind. Nous. And we have not done that. We have thought if you love God with your mind, you will stop loving God. So you must be without mind. And if you're without mind, then you can love God. But it is precisely the intelligence that God requires, the might that God requires, the emotions that God requires. Must all be put 2, 3 together. Then love your neighbor as yourself, and the neighbor is not defined. We have always tried to define the neighbor. And then John ends up in the epistle. You say you love God whom you have never seen. And you love, don't love your neighbor whom you have seen. Oh, you liars. That's the condemnation on the church, which does not go with those who are kept outside. And that's a missiological challenge to all of us. The Lord be with you. The Lord keep you. The Lord make Lord's face shine upon you. Questions? Fight. Fight with me.